Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
On today's show, we'll be meeting Helen Jukes, a writer and beekeeper whose new book has to be read to be believed. Sorry.
You should apologise for that, Fernando. Then we'll be discussing the work of arranger Ivor Raymond, whose work shaped the careers of everyone from Dusty Springfield to David Bowie, with his son, Simon, the founder of Bella Union record label and a former Cocteau twin.
And we'll be learning about the history of Lisbon with Barry Hutton, a journalist and author who has made the city his home for over 30 years.
Plus, Monocle's Bill Luty will be looking ahead to next week's news today, and we'll enjoy some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Well, there we have it, Fernando. You and I in the Monocle Weekly chairs. I think I'm right in saying, for the very first time, a premiere.
Tom, I think we've done every single show except the Monocle Weekly
exactly.
Together.
It was a matter of time before we'd get round to it. And, well, Bill Luty is jumping in for the weekly look ahead. This is your usual domain, Fernando. How do you feel about that? Well, you've been usurped.
Can I be honest? I feel good because then, you know, I don't know what to expect. I'm very curious what's happening next week, actually.
Well, if we know to expect anything, Fernando, when it comes to Bill Luty, it's to expect the unexpected. Let's call him in. Monocle's own worker bee is here. They've let him out for a few minutes. It's Bill Luty.
Which way you going, Billy? Can I go too? Which way?
Bill, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Reprising an occasional role as the seer of the week ahead.
Yeah.
Lots of pressure because the usual occupant of that chair, a recent occupant, is none other than Fernando, and he's in the presenter's chair today.
And Bill, I'm very curious because I did not do any research about what's happening next week.
Let's get the ball rolling.
Today, happy birthdays are in order. NASA is 60. Started by President Eisenhower in 1958. Specifically, and I like this, he wrote this in for for civilian, which he means peaceful exploration of space. Don't take guns into space. That I think that was his main message.
And what's been done to mark the occasion? Is there, I could imagine, a big cake shaped like a rocket, something like that?
Yeah, they're going to make that. They're going to fly a cake-shaped rocket into space.
They do send, I've seen a pie in space. They could send a cake up there.
Got to be honest, they're quite young. I was expecting them to be more than 60 years old.
What do you think?
Yeah, I was expecting like 80 or something.
In fact, what is interesting about that is, and then what, just a decade and change later,
they're in the moon.
Bang, there
they are. Planted a guy right there. That didn't take long. It's amazing, really. Bill, item two.
Should we move on to the ASEAN summit, which is taking place in Singapore? The foreign ministers of lots of Southeast Asian nations are coming together to discuss, well, you know, there's lots of summits. We've talked on Monocle 24 about how there are maybe slightly too many, but I think this one, these
kind of feel like that is a busy agenda.
Yeah.
This year's iteration, no?
But these countries, you know, Cambodia, Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, they are in a similar place, unlike BRICS, which is kind of dispersed across the world. They're all sort of in the same place economically. The theme of this year's summit is resilience and innovation, which I think
both qualities we could all do with, certainly, probably more of.
Are they all friendly with each other at this stage?
Yes, mostly. There was fear that that Malaysia were going to start taking a bit more of a back seat with their new government, but they've come and said, no, we're still committed. Don't worry. We are going to look elsewhere as well, but like ASEAN is our thing. Obviously, one of the big topics, the South China Sea.
Well, I was going to say, this is slightly one of those meetings where potentially the biggest actors
aren't
in terms
there.
Of the future are not going to be around the table. But, and this is what I wish more people in international diplomacy would bear in mind. Well, I say that, I'm talking to people like Donald Trump. Just because everyone's not there doesn't mean there's not value in getting together. Mm-hmm. Many heads are better than one. Is that an expression?
Especially when ganging up against China.
Well, there you go. You can coordinate your opposition. But seriously, so many very complex dynamics at play. It's got to be a good thing to get around a table, no?
Mm-hmm.
Have you got summit else for us, Bill?
On Friday is International Beer Day.
How does one take part? Just by getting involved? Drinking?
It's a global celebration of beer taking place in pubs, breweries, backyards all over the world. It's a day for beer lovers everywhere to raise a toast to our brewers and bartenders.
I can get involved with that.
The purpose of IBD, that's what they call it if you're in the beer biz, is threefold: to gather with friends and enjoy the deliciousness that is beer, to celebrate the dedicated people who brew and serve our beer, and to bring the world together in a sort of summit to celebrate beers of all nations and cultures. Do you have a favourite? Go on, Faye.
I was going to ask, what do you drink? Which beer do you like?
I mean, it's hard to go better than Belgian, isn't it? They've packed so much flavour and often quite a lot of alcohol into quite a small space.
I'm a bit the opposite. I like, you know, very light with no flavour from the Mediterranean. Mm. I mean, I usually stay in Spain for my beer.
Okay.
But that's because it's hot, you need to be refreshed, you would just want a little, not even a half pint, maybe less than
it
a half.
It is interesting. Yeah. It changes the drinking dynamics. You begin to realise how you get such regional disparity, because we've been on sort of the end of a almost unprecedented run of incredibly hot weather in London town. And I think my palate is shifting more to that sort of holiday mode.
Ah, because I wouldn't normally dream of a lager unless I was on the continent.
Well, no. And then, but you know, it seems the only way to go when the mercury is above 30, you need to get amongst it. A nice refreshing pilsner, nice and crisp. I'm lost in a reverie. Bill Lutie, There you go. That is all of next week's news today from here at Midori House. Time next to get busy with the world of bees. The United Kingdom and other nations around the globe have been mostly enjoying an uncommonly hot spell of weather in recent weeks. It might be good news for those escaping the office to head to the park, but what might it mean for some of the hardest workers in nature? Bees!
We thought we would ask this and also learn more about the ruminative and rewarding art of beekeeping to Helen Jukes. Her new book, A Honey Bee Heart Has 5 Openings, tells the story of how beekeeping gave her a different way of looking at the world.
And I'm delighted to say Helen joins us on the line right now. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Helen. It's wonderful to have you with us. Thanks for being on the show. And let me ask you a bit about that point Fernando just made there, this idea of a different perspective. I think bees are amongst the great sort of misunderstood or underestimated creatures in all of nature. Tell us a little bit about your story and why, I don't know, why their sort of narrative has proven to be so powerful for you.
I guess at the time that I became a beekeeper, I was working a pretty office-based job. And so I was spending most of every day indoors. And somehow, I mean, at that time, I'd moved into a house where I had a garden for the first time. And I think I found that somehow having a beehive opened up a slightly different space. It was a space outside of my normal everyday life.
Certainly here in London, there's been a pleasing uptick, it seems from without, in terms of the number of people who are not just engaging with bees and their needs and what they contribute, but also being very hands-on and doing beekeeping courses or trying to explore urban hives and this sort of thing. Was this something that had been in your mind anyway? I just wonder whether it was a completely sort of fresh idea, or had you always been sort of sympathetic to the bees' ongoing cause?
Yeah, I'd been really lucky when I was living in London. I'd been really lucky to do a very informal kind of apprenticeship. So I already sort of had a sense of the sort of different world that beekeeping opens up. It's probably important to mention that beekeeping doesn't help bees necessarily. There are maybe 250 species, I think, of bees in the UK. So honeybees are just one species and they don't need us to keep them. They would do totally fine on their own. And what they really need are more flowering habitats, which actually, it turns out, cities are really good for. They've got a lot more diversity at the moment than rural areas, where often big sort of monoculture farming can make it more difficult for bees to find forage. So I think beekeeping opens up a really amazing way of kind of engaging and remembering bees, but not necessarily directly helping them.
And Helen, I would like to talk a little bit about, you know, the structure of your book. You know, it chronicles, you know, your history of beekeeping, and it kind of goes month by month, I believe, right? So it's quite interesting because, you know, at the same time you do deep in the summer, you do in the winter, in the fall. Can you tell us a bit, I mean, how did you decide to structure your book?
Yeah, I guess one of the things about beekeeping is that it really opens you up to becoming more aware of the seasons and cyclical changes and rhythms in the natural world. And so it made sense in that way to structure the book following the course of a beekeeping year. There are different phases of beekeeping. So there's the sort of initial growth and expansion of a colony at the beginning of spring and through the summer, and then it reduces down again in the autumn, and then there's a point at the end of the summer when all of the workers begin starving drones to death. The drones are the male bees and the workers are the female bees. And the workers will literally kick out all of the male bees at the end of the season to reduce the colony right down to its bare minimum so that it can survive on its honey stores over winter.
Helen, it's interesting, you're talking there a little bit about the structure of the book. It's funny, it seems so elegant the way that you bring back the structures of bees and the demands of their life to your processes as a writer. And I wanted to ask you a bit more about that. And that's obviously something that you do with great skill in the book, which is to sort of chart your own journey that you go on, of something of a kind of crossroads, I guess, at the start of the story, as you've just described to us. Tell us about the challenge of doing that. Did it immediately fall into place that you found resonance in the complexities, the structures, the social dynamics of bees that actually offered interesting mirrors or parallels or contrasts with your own life? Did you sort of suddenly say, there's a whole nother layer of this that means something more to me? Was that serendipitous? Had you, I don't know, even subconsciously thought that that might happen?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think there was something about bees that really captured my imagination and really fascinated me. And early on in Oxford, another beekeeper that I know told me, you must keep an observation notebook. You should write in your notebook every time you open the hive or every time you notice something about the colony. So just make a note of it and it will be useful for as a beekeeper. So I started doing that and found that really quickly it wasn't just my observations of the hive that I was writing down. It was also things that I was thinking about the bees or bits of text that I'd read. And I think somehow in that way, the lines of connection began to flow quite quickly between what I was seeing at the hive and maybe what was happening for me in the rest of my life and what I was reading about the history of beekeeping and thinking about our place in the world more generally. So yeah, it sort of happened quite organically, I think.
Helen, I have a question for you. You know, what are the things you need to know before, you know, you decide to become a beekeeper? Because as I think you mentioned in the book, it's becoming, you know, quite a, you know, a common trend these days, even in big cities, which is quite nice. But what are the things we need to know about it before we start?
Yeah, I think it's really nice to learn about the colony before you learn about beekeeping. So that as you become a beekeeper, you have a sense of the creature that you're going to be keeping. And there are really good books around about the natural history of bees and about sort of colony processes that go on inside the hive. And so I think that's a really nice thing to do. I think as well, it's really good to be linked up when you get a hive because there are so many things about it that are so strange and confusing when you first start. And the colony can seem so full of chaos and disorder. I found it really useful to have linked up with a local beekeeping group and with friends who were beekeepers so that I could check in with them most weeks about the things that I was finding about the hive that I hadn't expected or that didn't seem to make sense to me. And in that way, I think slowly I gained some kind of sense of what was happening beneath this thing that seemed like chaos and disorder inside the hive.
And Helen, I guess as a sort of parallel to that, in terms of the book itself, it's very personal. It's sort of very emotionally intelligent. Do you find it as a writer, is that a challenge to commit those sorts of feelings, that emotional energy onto the page? Some writers that I've spoken to talk about the draining emotional energy from trying to commit their own emotions to the page. Others describe it as cathartic. Others describe it as actually being energizing because it enables them to focus in a new way. What's your experience? Because this is a deeply personal story as well.
Yeah, I found it really hard to write about myself. And I think I hadn't at all planned to when I started writing about the bees. I thought I was going to write something that was about honeybees and about beekeeping and didn't really want to make it about myself at all. But I think the more I wrote and as I began showing it and sharing it with people, the message kept coming back from readers that there was a personal story going on, but they couldn't hear it loudly enough. And so as I redrafted and reworked it, I think the personal story came out more each time. And I sometimes felt like I was standing in a room with two doors. One door was a door for describing the bees, and that was really easy each time. I just seemed to be able to do it very fluidly. And the other door was a door for talking about myself, and it was a much smaller and more tricky one.
And Helen, also, was there a moment perhaps that you wanted to give up? So basically, I would like to know, what are the challenges that you faced since you became a beekeeper?
When I was beekeeping a little with my friend Luke in London, I saw a dead colony one winter. They had become too cold where they were and somehow hadn't survived, and that was really awful. And I think it's probably part of beekeeping to see that every now and then, but it was really shocking. And I guess other times when I was in Oxford and I was beekeeping, probably the sort of chaos was also really difficult. And the fact that there was a point in the summer when they were growing so rapidly, as a colony will naturally try to do, that I found it difficult to sort of keep on top of the observations that I was making and my sense of what was going on in the hive. So I think the disorder inside the hive was also tricky for me.
And just finally, perhaps, and I know this picks up on some questions that Fernando's already asked you, in terms of what we like to issue a kind of call to action on this programme a little, what should people do? And it was striking what you said at the beginning about problems that different parts of the bigger bee population has. Would you say to people, look, get involved, find out about beekeeping? Or would you say, actually, look, it's more important to have a really well-planted window box if you live in a city, or just to be more aware of all the insect life around you? What's the thing that people could or should do? What would you encourage them to do? And then a final thought, what's the best lesson from bees? Is it the sort of old cliches about cooperation? What are those two key takeaways?
I think beekeeping opens up an amazing way of engaging with insect populations and pollinators, and an amazing way of connecting a bit more with the natural world. If that's something that people are interested in, I would definitely encourage them. I think changing how we garden is also really useful, and planting bee-friendly plants and making our gardens a more wildlife-friendly place and reducing use of pesticides in the garden. But I think there's also something that is maybe changing at the moment about people's sense of the world beyond their garden, and how there's a real importance for us to think about the way we're treating landscapes, and particularly rural landscapes more generally. And there are campaigns to reduce pesticide use or pesticide overuse. So I think for me, I think there is something really amazing about the way that a colony works together. And I think for me, there was also something really important about the sort of sensitivity of bees to their surroundings and to each other. That was something that I was really struck by each time I opened up the hive, that it's so affected by what's going on in the outside world, and bees are so attuned to each other. I think probably that was one of the things that I found most affecting about them.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tom, it's time for some music.
What have you got for me, Fernando?
Well, we have very good stuff here. In a moment, we'll be hearing from Bella Union Records boss Simon Raymond about the work of his father, musical arranger Ivor Raymond. Here is a song which his orchestral work is all over. This is David Bowie with Love You Till Tuesday.
That was David Bowie back in 1967 with Love You Till Tuesday. And, Fernando, there was a reason why we were playing that particular tune.
Absolutely, Tom. As head of Bella Union Records, you know the work of Simon Raymond, helping shape the careers of successful indie bands ranging from the Flaming Lips to Beach House. He's also been in influential bands himself, such as the Cocteau Twins and Lost Horizons.
But, and here's where that last track comes in, his latest project is a collection of songs that his father, the arranger, songwriter and musician Ivor Raymond, worked on from the 1950s until his death in 1990. Raymond Sr. worked behind the scenes creating hits and little-known wonders for artists ranging from David Bowie, of course, who you just heard, to Dusty Springfield. He wrote her mega-hit, I Only Want to Be With You. His works now collected in the new compilation Paradise, The Sound of Ivor Raymond. Monocle's Tom Hall sat down with Simon Raymond a bit earlier to talk about it.
Well, it started off really as a suggestion from Seymour Stein, who I was having lunch with many, many, many years ago, and he seemed to know more about my dad than I did, which was troubling, his work in particular. He said, you know, you should do a compilation of your dad's stuff. And I thought, yeah, you know, maybe I should do, but I was like kind of swamped in Bella Union stuff. I just kind of didn't really think of it anymore. And then I suppose about 6 or 7 years ago, moved down to Brighton where just there is more space. That's kind of why I got out of London. Being there by the sea gave me a bit more sort of contemplation time. And I started going through on Discogs and YouTube, just typing in his name and seeing what stuff came up. Really simple as that. I found it kind of astonishing that I pretty much didn't know 95% of the stuff he worked on. So I began listening to it all. I began buying a lot of the old 7-inches, some of them literally just one or two copies of them in existence, because they were just like almost like demos in those days. Some of them never even got into manufacturing. And I began a sort of obsessive collection of this stuff. And together with my friend Kieran Tyler, who helped me with this compilation, the licensing and all that stuff, we kind of put together a rough track listing. It did change because I kept discovering more and more stuff. When I thought I had it finished, I'd hear something else and go, oh, no, we haven't finished yet. This has just come up.
It's so funny that you had to go through that process in that way, because, I mean, I don't want to delve into your personal relationship, but for all intents and purposes, it seems to be the case that you had a pretty good relationship with your dad and nothing was sort of held back or anything. And
that is very true. Yeah. And I knew about the Walker Brothers, of course, because they were massive hits, weren't they? You know, everybody knows those songs, Sonic and Shiny More, Make It Easy on Yourself. I didn't know all the other little, you know, B-sides and stuff with Tom, I didn't know tracks with Tom Jones. And I didn't know he worked with Bowie either until much, much, much later, which is just bizarre.
Well, let's listen to some of those lesser-known songs. This is one that I really enjoyed from the compilation, and I'm sure many people do know some of these songs. I personally had just never heard it, and I thought it was great. This is Beautiful Friendship by Barbara Ruskin.
Some days I know I should not have been born, 'cause every single thing I say goes wrong. So wrong. So wrong, wrong.
The arrangement on a song like that is so important, because when you listen to the lyrics, they are the most miserable lyrics, actually, that if you just saw them on a page, you just think this is the most joyless thing.
It is a bit of a lost art, isn't it? And that's a very, very good point about the lyrics. I mean, so many songs from that period, if you just looked at the words alone, you'd think, my God, you know, a lot of the Motown songs, you know, a lot of soul music is, the lyrics are miserable, but the music is quite uplifting. And I think that's a really interesting point that maybe hasn't been made that much. Where do those arrangements come from? That's a good question. I think a lot of it is to do with orchestration, musical direction, kind of pop music people were making in those days, the studios, what they were trying to do, America, you know, whether Britain was copying America or vice versa. And that's something I'm not 100% sure about either, because people say, you know, were they influenced, the arrangers of the 60s, like my dad, like Reg Guest, Wally Stott, people like that, were they influenced by the sort of Nelson Riddle but Bacharach kind of things, or was it flip-sided? Because it's hard to know for sure. Phil Spector, you know, things like that. I don't know totally which came first, but it was it's a brilliant art. I mean, I would love to be able to do arrangements like that. And I mean, there are people out there today doing amazing arrangements, but it's very few and far between. I think it elevates the music immensely.
It's almost like a second opinion, an arranger, isn't it? Do you think that sort of collaborative element is lacking in a lot of modern pop songs, because you're constantly now just getting one person's vision, which they just dreamed up in their bedroom, shoved it through Pro Tools or whatever, and that's your end product? You don't get this second take on, as it could have been with Barbara, it could have been, yeah, these lyrics are super dowdy and miserable, let's give it a bit more energy or something like that. Do you think that sort of back and forth is missing a bit from modern pop writing?
Yes, I do, but I think it sort of comes from an industry perspective, because, you know, I remember in the 60s, it was almost like the sort of film studio system. You know, you had an A&R man and a producer who often sat in suits at the back of the studio, controlling proceedings and making sure this happened and that happened. And if they felt that they wanted to bring in a 12-piece brass section, then they would be the ones that decided about it. Today, artists, you know, have a lot more power over what they do. The costs of everything have skyrocketed. You know, to get a 25-piece orchestra in for the day, I mean, that's pretty much £25,000 right there. You know, and who has 25 grand to spend on a couple of tracks in a studio with a band? So everything's changed. The musical direction, that was a job in the 60s, not a job anymore. What would a musical director do? I mean, there's probably musical directors on BBC television working on the light entertainment shows, but not in the studios. The whole thing has changed. In the 80s, the work for these kind of people had totally dried up. There wasn't any, and he was no different. He wasn't getting any work at all. But I remember Ben Watt, through Cherry Red, and I obviously was a little bit involved in that world myself through my work, he contacted my dad and asked if he could go down. And I think he was excited to meet him, but, you know, vice versa. But I think he really just wanted to pick his brain. I think Dad was a bit sort of disappointed that he wasn't giving him some work. He just wanted to find out how he did his arrangements and what you know, how do you do that and what tricks, you know. And so it was, a lot of it is sort of begged and borrowed. Unfortunately, that, as I say, you know, that kind of work dried up a bit.
Well, let's listen to another one, which maybe someone like Ben Watt might have been picking your dad's brain for. This is Scott Walker, Make It Easy On Yourself.
Just tell me that we're through, and make it easy on yourself. Make it easy on yourself. 'Cause breaking up is so very hard to do.
And you're a musician yourself, Cocteau Twins, Snowbird, lots of other projects. When you look back on the music you've made, do you ever pick up dualities in the way that you and your dad might have worked?
I'd love to. I've tried, and I don't really. I mean, I think melody, there's definitely, I think that must be just sort of in the genes, or just in the influences I've had from home without maybe even realising it. As you said before, you know, I mean, I have sisters and brothers. I'm the youngest, so, you know, they were playing, and they're all old, obviously all older, so that they were all playing pop music of the time, you know, Beach Boys and Roxy Music, and, you know, there was so much music in the house all the time. So from when I was sort of able to listen to music, I was, without paying attention to it, sort of consuming it in a way.
Yeah.
And I do think that's probably rubbed off on me, because I definitely have melody in there. That's my thing, you know. I do love melodies and harmonies, and that's my sort of strong suit as far as my own musicianship goes.
It's probably something that other people can pick out maybe a bit easier and better than you can, because it's like, it's always one of those things, like people say it about sons and their fathers, they're like, oh, you do that exactly the same thing, it never even occurred to you.
No, yeah, you know, you always say no. And I do that a lot. And people say to me, you know, you could definitely arrange. And I'm like, no. And maybe I will think about it at some point. I think what I've got to do is get this record out first and sort of, I don't know, just let that out there, that this thing that I've been working on for so long, it feels like a sort of labour of love. And once I get it out there, maybe I can just relax and think about my own thing again.
We can only play a handful of tracks in this interview. And, you know, Tom Jones, David Bowie, they're on there. But I'm kind of interested in some of the more obscure ones. I want to listen to The Honey Bus. This is a song called She Sold Blackpool Rock. Has this been sampled or ripped off by someone? Because the beginning arrangement, it sounds so familiar, but I've never heard the song. So let's give it a quick listen and we'll talk about it.
I can't forget the games we played.
She told me that she knew
in the sun.
She sold Blackpool Rock. Tell me about the Honey Bus. Who were they, and why would I know the sounds of those strings? I mean, have you heard them ripped off on any other records?
Well, I think, you know, ultimately everything is ripped off.
It's true.
You
know, that's how music works.
That's kind of how it works. And I think doing something like this, which is looking at a period of music that isn't my genre at all, has been, you know, as much of an eye opener as finding out about my own dad. When I heard this, and when I heard there's another British band that he worked with called The Flies.
Yeah.
There's a cover of
I'm Not Your Stepping
Stone. Yeah,
I'm
Not Your Stepping Stone, which I loved. I was like, oh, gosh, you did this kind of stuff too, like psychedelic things. It was almost like a punk rock track, that Flies version. And a lot of Northern Soul. Pretty much he was Joe Meek's, like, go-to musical director. So Joe Meek, obviously legendary producer from that period, you know, pretty much recorded most tracks in his house. And Dad would go down there with his band or whoever he chose to, you know, put the music together in the morning, set the band up, rehearse them a little bit. Joe would come in, they'd record in the afternoon, and then everyone would go home. that's kind of like how these things worked often. And they were probably discussed over a cup of tea, do you know what I mean? It was all done so quickly. Even albums were recorded in a day in those days.
Yeah.
My dad was an A&R man at Decca Studios. And what that meant in those days was he would bring in projects to the label. And this would have been one of those. They actually changed their name from The Honey Bus to just Honey Bus eventually. And I think they petered out after like one album. Like a lot of bands did then. The Flies didn't last longer than an album or so. There's so many unknown people from that period that are now cropping up into my brain. To help introduce some of them, even on this compilation, is a real honour.
Well, let's end on a very well-known singer. This is Ian Dury and Superman's Big Sister. This is what I mean about the work of an arranger. You wouldn't really think that a band like Ian Dury and the Blockheads were sort of an arrangement band. You think of them as, you know, basically like dirty disco, post-punk almost. Even if you heard this song, you'd be like, yeah, there's some strings on it, they're great, but you don't think about where it comes from. And it's only when you start listening to a record in the context of the arrangement that you're like, these are like stunning. If you took the bass and the hi-hats off and stuff and just played the actual orchestra underneath it, it would be like a little symphony in itself. It's amazing. So was your dad aware of the sort of genre jumping, or was it just a real, I'll turn up, I'll do the work, however you give me the brief? Or did he have favourite songs to be making or favourite genres to be working in?
Oh, you know, that's a good question, but I think no. I think he really was one of those people that just did the work and was really grateful to get work. There's so much stuff out there we don't know anything about. But Dad was obviously in the right place at the right time and loving to be able to be involved, whatever the genre. And, you know, you think of your parents, you know, oh, I know what they're like. They can do this. And then this whole journey has been me going, oh. And I've just been going, oh, for like 7 years. And I'm still doing it. It's really quite strange.
She's Superman's big sister.
Simon Raymond there, speaking to Monaco's Stone Hall. And Paradise, the Sound of Ivor Raymond, is out this week on the 3rd of August. You're listening to the Monaco Weekly.
Today we know it as a thriving startup hub and weekend hangout for young getaway seekers in the sun. But Lisbon, Portugal's capital, of course, has a much more storied past. More than 2,000 years of it, in fact.
Writer and journalist Barry Hutton has been living in Portugal since 1986, and his new book, Queen of the Sea, A History of Lisbon, looks at the city's past, taking in its Roman origins to devastating earthquakes, tsunamis, and political upheaval along the way.
And I'm delighted to say he joins us now on the line to tell us more. Barry Hutton, welcome to the Monaco Weekly. Thank you so much for joining us from Lisbon, indeed. Let me start with a question about, I guess it's as much about geography as anything else. Is Lisbon a European city? It always seems funny, you know, it's closer to Africa, not just in parts of its history, but in terms of its geography. How would you describe it to someone who was asking such a crude and descriptive question as that?
Well, that's very true, Tom. I mean, Lisbon and Portugal have always been out here, of course, on the southwestern edge of Europe. As you say, closer to Africa than, for example, to Brussels or London or Berlin. That's not just geography. I think that is reflected very much in the culture as well, which is one of the great appeals of Lisbon, in fact, is this wonderful mix. As I say, the secret is in the mix. Lisbon has got this very specific mood to it, a very African influence because, obviously, of its proximity to Africa, but also because of the slave trade and the colonies, the five colonies that we used to have in Portugal. You also have the Brazilian influence, of course, which Fernando will know all about. You have an Asian influence because of the colonies over there, Macau, East Timor, right over there by Australia. So really it has this fascinating mix of cultures and is also, of course, very tolerant because of that, I think, is another part of its appeal.
And this is something you know personally, of course, Barry, very well. We mentioned in our introduction you've been living there since the 1980s. There's a twang in your voice. Is it Doncaster? Is that the region? What brought you there? And I wonder what's the experience of, you know, a Brit abroad? I know you've got a Portuguese wife. Your children were brought up there. That gives a different sort of perspective as well. But I guess the sort of the traveller's perspective is something that is also very significant for Lisbon.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, you know, something I've used in my book about the Queen of the Sea, the history of Lisbon that's just come out now. I've used a lot of sort of letters from British travellers, German travellers, Dutch travellers who came through the city over the centuries. For me, of course, coming from the north of England, it's a bit different here. You know, the skies are very different colour and the food is a lot more tasty. Ever since I was young, I'd always wanted to live somewhere with blue sky, and it just happened to turn out to be Lisbon. When I came over here, I came on sort of a wing and a prayer back, as you say, in the mid-1980s, just looking for a job as a journalist. And it worked out, of course, very well for me. But what I like about it, it's so very different from the north of Europe. At that time, before I knew Portugal, before I knew Lisbon, it would sound very exotic to me, very romantic. You know, remember that Bob Dylan song, I think it's Sarah, it talks about drinking Portugal wine. I just sort of latched onto that, and it seemed so, as I say, so far away, so exotic, that I just had to come and check it out.
Barry, I have a question for you. I mean, clearly, you know, Lisbon is impossibly cool these days. Do you feel protective about the city? You know, because I believe, you know, from the next years, you know, it might become a new Barcelona when it comes to tourism, people buying property. How do you feel about the city and its near future?
That's true, Fernando. I mean, it's one that's a case of be careful what you wish for. I mean, I and many Portuguese were sort of stumped for a long time about why more tourists didn't come to Lisbon when it's such a wonderful place. And now, of course, they started flocking here in the last 2 years, really, started last year, and we're in danger of reaching a kind of over-tourism stage, which people complained about, as you say, in Barcelona or Prague. It's obviously a very valid concern. At times you feel like you're getting muscled out of the centre of Lisbon now in the high season. It's a bit like, you know, Oxford Street on Christmas Eve. Having said that, the weather here is so good for so long, you can come here right through out of season. I mean, it's really from sort of April, May time right through to November and still have fine weather. So there is that. But as you say, it's a double-edged sword. People are concerned about it, and rightly so.
Barry, let's drill down a little bit into the book and some of the history here. And I think one of the interesting sort of punctuation points, if you like, and so many great cities and great city stories have this, takes us back to what the sort of the middle of the 18th century, when, of course, there was this extraordinary natural disaster that befell Lisbon. Can you tell us a bit about, well, remind us about that event, of course, and tell us a bit about how that's informed the history? Because I guess, like London, we have sort of versions of that, you know, the Great Fire of 1666, and that sort of reshaped the city in one way. But this was a reshaping of a quite different scale.
It really sets the city apart, because what happened was, during the Age of Discovery, when Portugal was, you know, finding the sea route to India with Vasco da Gama and discovering Brazil and bringing the exotic spices and what have you over from India and really cornering the trade in spices, snatching it away from Venice, Lisbon was a hugely wealthy city. It's hard to imagine now. This was the place where, you know, the sailors, the explorers, the navigators were going out around the world and bringing back news from what was happening on different continents, months and months away by ship. And of course, Lisbon, the monarchy built these wonderful palaces, church built huge convents and churches. There was a fantastic opera house, one of the best in Europe, for example. And of course, along came November the 1st, All Saints Day in 1755. Massive earthquake, believed to be the biggest ever to have hit Western Europe. Thousands of dead, two-thirds of the city reduced to rubble. After that, a tsunami came speeding up the Tagus, swept away people who'd run down to the river to escape the falling buildings, and followed by a six-day fire, which was so bad you could read by it at night, and with localised infernos where sand was turned into glass, it was so hot. So, I mean, a huge natural disaster. And that changed completely Lisbon, because nowadays, if, for example, if you go to Rome, you can find an old building, a thousands-year-old building, probably on pretty much every corner down in the centre. But in Lisbon, you don't get that, because Lisbon then had to be rebuilt. They even thought about rebuilding it somewhere else, somewhere a bit safer, sort of 10 kilometres to the west, where it was solid limestone rock. As they rebuilt it, the Marquis of Pombal is a great figure in Portuguese history. He insisted on bringing this sort of northern European mentality to the downtown area and rebuilt it in something that's very un-Portuguese. It's sort of a gridiron pattern, sort of four-storey high buildings, very sort of austere, kind of like Austrian, Viennese style, if you like. Bit of London there too, because he was in both of those cities as a diplomat. And then that contrasts very starkly with the older part around St. George's Castle, where you have the more Arabic-like, you know, obviously Lisbon and Portugal were occupied by the Moors from North Africa for seven centuries, just like Spain. And so that oldest part around the castle, where places called Alfama and Mouradia, with very narrow alleyways, you feel like you're in a souk almost as you're walking around there. There's a glaring contrast then with the downtown, as I say, with this gridiron pattern and the broad streets. It's one of those contrasts that make a city special, and I think it does work in Lisbon.
And Barry, it seems to me that Lisbon is a very resilient city because, you know, a couple of decades after the earthquake, they also have been invaded by the French. What can you tell us about that?
That's true. I mean, I think that comes down a lot to the Portuguese people, the people of the city of Lisbon. As I say in my book, Lisbon is, as much as anything, it's a mood, it's a way of being in life, it's an attitude, and that comes from the local people. If you know the Portuguese, anyone who knows the Portuguese knows it's legendary how hospitable, how friendly, just how plain nice they are. And I think what has shone through all through Portuguese history is the way that these people have managed to bounce back every time. As you said, Napoleon's armies in the early 19th century, Napoleon's army came in, occupied Lisbon and large parts of Portugal. Didn't work very well because the Portuguese don't take kindly to that kind of thing. As I say, they're very friendly, but if you tread on their toes, they can blow their top. So they didn't react very well to the French. And with British help, the help of who would become the Duke of Wellington, managed to push them out. So it was another episode where they survived and flourished afterwards.
And if we look at the different kind of tyranny, and something that's kind of seems extraordinarily recent in some ways, and that's the military dictatorship of the 20th century, Barry, to ask you about that. And it's funny, I suppose, in some ways, I don't know what your view of this would be, to reflect that that dictatorship only came to an end, relatively recently, even in terms of your arrival in the city, which is rather extraordinary if you look back now. What impact did that have on that character, on the spirit of the city, if you like?
Yeah, well, it's funny. I mean, the military dictatorship started in the late 1920s, and then we got a dictator set up called Antonio Salazar. Basically, Portugal had Salazar, while Spain had General Franco. It was pretty much the same, Iberian dictators. The dictatorship was finally toppled only as recently as 1974 in the Carnation Revolution, which, you know, was an army coup, but unlike most army coups, the army didn't seize power. They turned the country into a democracy. Oddly enough, the nobody likes to talk about Salazar in Portugal these days. He's sort of someone, he's sort of the embarrassment, is the, you know, the odd relation that no one likes to mention. And so he's been sort of swept aside. There was a big attempt to sort of scrub Lisbon clean of any mention of Salazar. But of course, for the sort of four decades in power, he had a huge impact. His regime was called the New State. It had a huge impact on the city's architecture, the city's layout, including the first bridge over the River Tagus, which bears a remarkable similarity to the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, and was actually built by the American Bridge Company. When I arrived then, as I say, in 1986, Portugal had just joined the European Union, or the European Economic Community as it was then called, alongside Spain. And that then sort of catapulted the city into a whole new phase of regeneration and huge investment, with a huge new bridge across the Tagus, the biggest in Western Europe, lots of, you know, facelifts of these older buildings downtown. So there was a lot of worry about the city losing its character, but it really hasn't happened, because the Portuguese are just as they always were.
Barry, it's a delight to speak with you. And Queen of the Sea, A History of Lisbon, Barry's book, which I should say, Barry, has a very charming cover. Forgive me for butchering the language. It's sort of azulejo tiles, isn't it? That's the...
hand-painted tiles, that's right.
It's a thing of beauty in terms of its contents and in terms of its appearance. And I encourage our listeners to track down a copy. Barry, thanks so much for joining us from Lisbon.
And thank you.
Fernando, there you have it. I hope you'll agree that we did our best for your debut in the presenter's chair. Sort of a little Portuguese flavour in there. What are those Portuguese tiles called again?
Azulejo.
Azulejo.
And you pronounced amazingly well, Tom. I can't... You know, actually, I told you in the office...
This doesn't mean you're not allowed to come back again just because you're being nice to me. Nice to me right now. But what a show. Great sounds. Fascinating. I'd love to hear more. I'm very interested in bees, generally. And I like to talk to other people who... are interested in the workings of the bee. Very complex mind, even though it's tiny.
I think it's very nice. A lot of kind of, especially young people in cities are, you know, are moving to beekeeping. I think this is a fantastic idea.
And here's a question for you, Faye. I don't know, on your, I know you have some sort of lavish roof terrace on your sort of pied-à-terre. And so are you gonna change it up, upgrade your window boxes, get some more bee-friendly.
I'll speak with my neighbours, because I can see from the rooftop, actually, in Soho, London, right here in the centre, I can see some people beekeeping, very close to me.
Well, you need to get a little sort of smorgasbord lined up.
Maybe a Soho production of some nice honey.
And if you eat, someone told me this other day, if you eat honey that's made by your local bees, if you have hay fever, it helps to... like immunize you, because the bees' crazy magical powers.
You should bring some to us. I know you have a favorite brand there.
Shout out to B17,
yes,
from Walthamstow in East London. Yeah, absolutely. And that does indeed bring the curtain down on this edition of the Monocle Weekly. Thank you to you, Faye. Thanks to the gang behind the glass. That's our producers, Tom Hall and Augustin Macellari, our research crew of Paola Schulze and Julia Webster, and of course our studio managers, Cassie Galpin and Kenya Scarlett.
The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
And from me, Tom Edwards. Goodbye.